Well, let's talk with John Beaver right now, president of Phase 3 Advisory Services. He's a registered investment advisory firm and regional principal with Royal Alliance Associates. Let me start with this, John. We talk about the recession, and maybe we are in one, but are all recessions the same? Is this one going to be worse or not as bad as some in the past? What's your read on that?
So if we're in one right now, I don't think it's going to be nearly as bad as those in the past. We certainly have one coming. There's always another recession. When the next one comes, nobody knows for sure. My guess is next year. I think this is just a temporary little blip we're in right now. But I don't think it's going to be as bad. We're still in the early stages of the ramp-up of inflation, and usually the bad recessions come when we have persistently high inflation. And I don't see that for a decade yet. So I think that the next one will be fairly mild.
Do you think that we've peaked for the time being on the index on inflation?
It looks like it. CPI this month came in, or for last month actually came in at 0.3%, which is the lowest in 8 months. The PPI came in at 0.5% for the month of April. And that's now at a four-month low, so that's good. We were running over 1% per month on the PPI. Today, import prices came in unchanged. So I think the worst may be over for right now, generally speaking, but certainly not in food or energy.
Why do you think it's going to get worse then down the road?
So there's this phenomenon that when inflation starts to heat up, it moves back and forth very high, then drops really low, then high, then low, and then kind of settle in, and then we kind of get this persistent rise. And with all of the government spending, with all the debt that's out there, it's somewhat inevitable that we're going to have some inflation. The government wants inflation. They need inflation because that's partly how they bail out their debt. And it's really tough to manage that. The Federal Reserve has shown, in history at least, that they haven't been really good at managing this process. So I think we're going to go into an inflationary cycle here that could last a couple of decades. And it's important for investors to kind of set their mindset. Now, having said that, we're not going to be sitting here at 8% inflation year after year. It will be volatile. We may see a couple of years of actual deflation or close to zero as we're working through this process. But in terms of the persistent inflation that we saw in the 1970s, that may still be 5 to 10 years out, but I think we will see that period.
What do you think about energy costs?
Going up, and that's because supply issues. We just do not have enough supply. We're still using a lot, over 100 million barrels a day. That demand is going to continue to increase. So until we can significantly increase supply, whether that be through some change in Russia, which I don't see right now, or we get some more supply in the market, we're going to have higher prices ahead. And, of course, then that affects food because a lot of the input cost on food is energy.
I'm going to ask you about housing. I'm going to ask you about investing in a minute. Stay right there. We're talking to John Beaver. John, what are you seeing about the housing index right now and prices? I wonder how these escalating numbers are going to affect that.
Yeah, so there's two major inputs that we look at with housing. The first is supply and demand, and the other one is the rates. So let's talk about rates first because that's obviously in the news. You know, going back to the recession question, there have been 14 rate hike cycles that the Fed has taken us through since World War II. 11 of those ended in a recession. The Fed is so far behind the curve here, they have to raise rates so much, I don't see how we can avoid a recession. That is going to have some effect on housing. As the rates go up, obviously, that makes houses less affordable because the mortgage rates are higher. Think about this. Mortgage rates have doubled in the last year and a half. And that's just really difficult on first-time home buyers. And, in fact, I was just talking with a client the other day. They were going to downsize for retirement. They've decided, you know what, we're going to take a mortgage in retirement. We're just going to wait because we're at 2.75% right now. We don't want to go to 5.75%. So it's starting to affect investor behavior. So that's on the rate side. Now, on the supply and demand side, we are way behind in building. It's estimated that we're about 5 million units short at this point in time. And it's been about 15 years now that we've been running on the short side, not building enough, and it's really catching up at this point in time. You know, back in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, we were building about 1.5 million units a year, and the last 10, 15 years we've been only building about 500,000. So that's why we're so short right now. So the demand is going to stay here for quite a while because we're so short. We've got the millennials still forming households. And also with people coming across the border, you bring 2 million across the border every year, they need places to live too. So there's a lot of demand here. interesting thing is this is pretty similar to post-World War II, and so we have some clues there in that, and demand doesn't go away. It may subside as these rates get really high, but eventually the rates will settle in. In fact, I think the mortgage rates are actually a little ahead of themselves at this point in time in anticipation of the Fed continuing to raise rates. But mortgage rates key off of the 10-year Treasury. So if you're looking to get a mortgage, it's the 10-year Treasury rate that you want to keep your eye on.
Maybe people should invest in home building companies.
I think they'll be in business for quite a while with the demand that's going to be there. At least, you know, this is all in my opinion. And we're even short on the multifamily housing, too. You know, it's not just houses, it's also apartments. We have been really short building that for quite a while. Suddenly, just in the last year, we're really starting to pick up that pace by about 200,000 extra units a year, which is good, but that's not nearly enough.
Forget who it was. Somebody was on this show earlier this week, and they were saying if you're thinking stocks and bonds aren't complementing each other, so where do you go? Is there any kind of safe haven? And they said if it was real estate, it would be in those great big warehouses. I drove by the Granger warehouse near Manuka the other day, and I don't think I've ever seen a bigger building in my life. And I thought those things probably cost a lot. I know they're empty buildings, you know, I mean, it's a warehouse, but it would seem to me like there is some investment opportunity there. I don't know what you do, how you capture that, but that sector of the market is intriguing. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, there are real estate investment trusts that do focus on industrial, and that is something that someone could certainly look at. And, you know, you go north on 94 and just take a look at what Uline has done just in this area. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, do you have any other areas that you think people should think about when they watch their 401ks dwindle?
So one more thing on housing. It now takes about 8 years' worth of income to buy a house. And just, you know, 15 years ago or so, it was about the same when we were at the high just before the financial crisis in 2006. But between 2006 and now, it dropped down to about 5 years of income to buy a house. That just kind of puts it in perspective. We're back to affordability where we were in 2006. We don't know what that means in terms of the future. Our price is going to continue to push up. But rents are inflation protection. So buying a home for rent or getting into the real estate market right now might not be a bad way to go because of that rental protection that gives you inflation protection.
As far as stocks and bonds, I think a lot of us are doing the math in our heads right now, John. You said 8 years. So if you're average right now, if you make $50,000 a year, you're probably trying to buy a $400,000 house, or the house is costing you $400,000. Is that what you're saying?
The one that you would be looking at. Yeah, the one that you would be looking at would cost you that number. Correct. Right.
And is that a reflection? And is that a reflection of rising home prices or lower pay? People are getting paid more these days, right?
Yeah, people are getting paid more. So far, wages are not keeping pace with inflation in this next cycle here. We are lagging a little bit, but it's two things on the input side. It's the price, which is going up quite dramatically because of excess demand, but also the mortgage rates are going up, which pushes up your monthly payment. That's how people think about buying a house, is the monthly payment.
Yeah. I'm out of time.
So stocks and bonds are another question.
I'm out of time now. We'll have to pick it up here next time, John. Thank you for your help today.
Right. You bet.
John Beaver is the president of Phase 3 Advisory Services. Okay, let's talk to the Friends of the Chicago River's Margaret Frisbee. She's the executive director. And Margaret, you want us to help clean the river starting tomorrow. Is that right?
That's right, John. We're hoping people will join us for the 30th annual Chicago River Day.
So how does that work? As you imagine, mostly people that live along the river corridors, or do folks come from out of town? What happens?
Yeah, people come from all over. In fact, we have a record 77 locations along the Chicago Calumet Rivers. So the river edge sites are where people will be working, but volunteers are coming from everywhere because they know that, you know, the river is part of our communities. It's exciting. It's a river in recovery, and they really want to roll up their sleeves and help.
What does a river in recovery mean?
Well, it means that the water's cleaner than it used to be, that we used to have about 7 species of fish, and now we have over 70. And it really means that a river that once was really, you know, designed into our sewer system, frankly, has become a natural and recreational asset.
When people are cleaning up tomorrow, are they just walking along the shore, or are they in the water, like with nets?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. In fact, they're both. So we have people at River Edge Parks, River Edge Forest Preserves, along, you know, behind shopping malls, all up and down the river. And then there's also people at a bunch of locations in canoes or kayaks. So, like, the Mars Wrigley team will be at North Avenue in the city and kayaks picking up trash. And there's different volunteers in different places on the water.
I'm really glad to hear that. And then how do you define the Chicago River? Where does it begin and end? How far out are you going?
The river system, the way we define it, is 156 miles. And it's really because, of course, we've re-engineered the Chicago and Calumet rivers, and so they're hydrologically connected. But there's also miles and miles of tributary streams in the forest preserves. And so we do projects and work along those tributary streams, like at Palos and, you know, up in the forest preserves on the North Branch.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm wondering. So, like, tell me how far north, like, I'm thinking of the branch, the Y branch there downtown.
Oh, sure, right.
If I go north, how far north am I going to go? Up to where?
Up to Lake County. So the Brook and Northbrook, which is Cook County, but the Brook and Northbrook is part of the Chicago River systems, as is the Skokie Lagoon. And the northern part is basically Park City, which is near Waukegan. So 7 miles from the Wisconsin border. So way farther than people really realize.
Yeah, no kidding. And then how far south do you go?
Well, the Calumet goes, you know, along the southeast side of the city and then out to Palos. So we work on the Sanitarian Ship Canal. We work on the CalSeg Channel and then the Little Calumet as well. So it's a lot of miles of waterway, and a lot of it is surprisingly natural. People kind of picture the river downtown where it's, you know, high rises in the Chicago Riverwalk. But a lot of it really is forest preserves and park and residential. So it's really important to clean up the river in those communities as well.
How do people do it then? What's the means? Do I just bend over with a big green garbage bag? How do we do this?
That's a good question. So what happens is people come, we give everyone a free T-shirt, which is a lot of fun. And this year's theme is the Blanding's Turtle, which is an endangered turtle in Illinois. And the work we're doing at Friends of the Chicago River is helping turtle habitat, among other things. And so people turn up, they get a T-shirt, they get some garbage bags, they get gloves, they get grabbers. And then you just walk along and pick up trash. And there's a volunteer site captain at every site who helps people understand what the rules are and how to handle it. And, you know, we want to make sure people are safe and so they don't pick up anything sharp or dangerous and they just report it. But it's a great event and it's really got a lot of camaraderie. So there's kids, there's corporate teams, you know, people from all ages, from all over.
Oh, this is I'm so glad you're telling us all about this. I hope it's not too late. That is, do I go on a website, look for a location near me? How do I get involved?
Yeah, so people go to chicagoriver.org, which is Friends' website, and right on the front page, you can just click through to Chicago River Day, and there's a map, and some of the locations are sold out, as it were, you know, that the volunteer capacity is complete, but you can see just on the map where we need help, and, you know, we accept walk-ups because we know that we need as many hands on deck, and people find this to be really satisfying. It's a tangible thing, makes a real difference on the day of, and then it also, you know, builds community around this resource that we're working so hard to improve.
You know, we so see the river downtown, of course, as you said a moment ago, and it's discouraging sometimes just to see debris floating there or maybe coalescing in certain pockets. Is somebody going to go up and down there and clean that stuff out?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure about the activities tomorrow, but we are working on broader public policy initiatives to work on all trash and the litter. In fact, Friends has a goal for litter-free Chicago Calumet River system. And so we've been working at the state level on a styrofoam ban or polystyrene ban, and we're looking at, you know, where are garbage cans placed? Do they have lids on? You know, we know that from the research that we've done in volunteers cleaning up the river system, that more than 50% of the litter that we find is food related. And so that gets to your plastic bottles and bags from restaurants. And so how do you reduce what people are given so that there's not that much trash accumulating to end up sometimes even just blowing from the wind into the water?
Yeah, right. You wonder sometimes how it gets there, and maybe it's not bad people, it's just bad practice. It's bad programs by the city. So what comes out of the river? Are you surprised sometimes?
Well, the Chicago River Day list of things we found are pretty funny. We find coconuts, we find golf balls, we find suitcases, we find shopping carts, picnic tables, all kinds of things you would not expect people are putting in the river, and yet they are. But typically it's really food waste, you know, or food, you know, leftover stuff. But there are a wide array of creative things that people still end up in the river. And, you know, part of it is public education about, you know, finding what to do with your stuff rather than leaving it in the bank, putting it in a garbage can where it might end up in the river.
So 156 miles, cleaning it up tomorrow for much of the day. Do I volunteer all day? Can I do an hour-long shift?
You can come for as long as you want, but the maximum is about 3 hours because, you know, it's a bunch of work. And, you know, it's out in the sun or sometimes the rain. You know, it's you know, basically all-weather event. And so we want to make sure people work long enough to make a big difference but not exhaust them by doing it all day long. And we do have a litter-free Chicago River program where people can come out any day they want, and we've got toolkits that will help you organize a group. This year we're launching litter supply stations where people can work with friends and actually go get free supplies that they can use to do their own volunteer cleanups.
I'm really glad to hear that. Boy, it'd be nice if the Park District had a program like that, too. I don't know if they do, but I think people would be inclined to help out more often if we would just make it easier for them to help. So good on you. ChicagoRiver.org is where I sign up. And actually, it's 9 to noon tomorrow. I made it sound like it's all day. 9 to noon is really the organized thrust tomorrow, right?
That's right. Yep.
Okay, ChicagoRiver.org, ChicagoRiver.org. Good on you, Margaret Frisbee. Everybody help out, and let's talk again sometime soon.
All right, thanks, and hope to see you tomorrow or at least another time. Have a great day.
You betcha. 1243 on WGN. The Wintrust Business Lunch continues with more business news and Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Pilots at United Airlines say they've reached a new contract with the Chicago-based carrier. Terms of the deal haven't been disclosed and will be finalized before being presented to members in the coming weeks, according to Cranes. The deal comes as United prepares for a busy travel season. It's expected to be United's busiest flying season in 2 years. Talks are underway for the purchase of two distressed office properties in the Loop that could be a boost to downtown's recovery. The purchaser is reportedly the same developer who bought the Thompson Center. Cranes reports Prime Group is working on a deal to acquire office buildings at 115 South LaSalle and 111 West Monroe. BMO Harris Bank and law firm Chapman and Cutler are currently located in those buildings. If successful, Prime Group would purchase a $191 million loan tied to the buildings. Today marks the final day for the Illinois Governor's Office at the Thompson Center. The office is moving following the sale of the building. The building opened in 1985 as the State of Illinois Center. It was renamed in 1993 in honor of former Illinois Governor Jim Thompson. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, now the business of what you got for us, Steve Alexander.
Well, happy Friday the 13th, John. Is it treating you okay? Everything okay?
So far, so good. How about you?
Fine. So, Mr. Fizz, Friday, our gardening guru Jim Fizzell is back. The heat is back as well. Grass is growing. John's digging dandelions. We got a lot of work to do, don't we, Jim?
We do. In fact, we said last week that we'd talk a little bit about getting started in the garden today. First of all, a lot of people had some flooding, and they wanted to know, is it all right to plant there? It is once it dries out, if there isn't a bunch of trash or contaminants like chemicals or oil that have gotten into them. If that's happened to your garden or to your little farm that you have, that's something you need to take care of. And you can apply some nitrogen fertilizer to those areas because nitrogen will stimulate the bacteria that clean that stuff up. Then turn that soil over, thoroughly mixing the contaminated soil with the soil underneath it. Now, what you'll be doing in the garden? Well, we do need to spade the garden over and work it up for planting. And that's as soon as the soil is dry enough. We talked last week about taking a handful, squeezing it into a ball, and crumbling it. If that works, go ahead and dig your garden and get it ready to go. Then it's time to set out plants like colds, and these would be cabbages and broccoli and cauliflower and so forth, as well as lettuce, spinach, some of the hardy herbs. And it's time to direct seed some things because they're not going to be up for 2 weeks anyway, and by then frost will be certainly over. Radishes, carrots, beets, and some of the greens. And normally people talk about planting seed potatoes on Good Friday. That's a little bit late for that, but it doesn't matter. They can still be planted along with onion sets and perennials. Now, if you are a gambler, and it's a 50% gambler right now, it's time to set up some of the tender things like the tomatoes and some of the tender annuals. And it's time to start some seeds indoors. New seedlings can be ready in about 6 weeks. These would be tomatoes, peppers, marigolds, zinnias, and so forth. So there's no need to hurry. There's plenty of time. But we do need to get things underway now.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Fizz. Another tip from personal experience, be sure to stretch and limber up before you tackle those yard chores. And one more thing. One of the listeners a few days back, said John should not be digging dandelions and mowing his lawn, that he should be observing No Mow May. Are you on board with that, Jim?
No, I'm not on to that. There are plenty of other things. And if people want to mow their grass and if they want to dig their dandelions, that's fine. Jane has been doing the same thing. We've got an old dandelion digger that belonged to my grandfather, as a matter of fact. And she goes out with that dandelion digger, and she gets those little rascals as soon as they show up.
Mr. Fizz, Jim Fizzell, from the tree to your belly, today is National Apple Pie Day. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Let's close talking a little bit about this nationwide formula shortage. John Quelch is the author of something called Consumers, Corporations, Public Health, and Public Health. He's the dean of the Miami Herbert Business School at the University of Miami. John, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Good. And a happy Friday the 13th to you.
Oh, that's right. It is that. Well, we've had some bad luck here, haven't we? What's happened with the baby formula?
Yeah, so this stems from a significant recall by the FDA via Abbott Nutrition, which has a large plant in Michigan that makes Similac and other baby formulas. This process started in February and perhaps has not received as much attention as it should have done, and as a result we're in a crisis situation at the moment where a significant number of mothers can't find the preferred brands of formula for their infants. And baby formula is actually a special product in the sense that naturally, mothers are very concerned about getting a formula that their babies find palatable and enjoy. And therefore, if their specific brand or formula is not available, it's very difficult to come to terms with risking switching the baby to a different formula for fear that that might cause stomach upset or the baby might reject the formula entirely. So this is quite a high-risk product from the point of view of young mothers, and understandably there's a lot of concern about the shortages, which are now reaching allegedly around about 40% of supermarket shelves.
So this defective brand this year, was it recalled? Did they stop making it and that's what's been missing?
Yes,
is it a specific brand?
There's a specific brand, Similac, that Abbott Nutrition is the manufacturer of. And this particular plant in Michigan is quite a large plant. There was a question raised by the FDA regarding bacterial contamination from this plant. There's some dispute as to whether or not the FDA and Abbott have been working aggressively enough with each other to bring the plant back online sooner rather than later. But as of now, the plant is not back online. Other manufacturers, of course, are doubling down on their production to try and fill in the gap. And indeed, Abbott and other companies are air freighting baby formula in from Europe, from their plants in Europe, to try and cope with the problem. But, you know, frankly, among supply chain issues that we would not have expected to have to address, this is definitely one of them.
Yeah, you can imagine the parents throwing their hands up and saying, now this. Did the agency, did the FDA overreact? I mean, when you do the math, it's still a microscopic percentage of children that were affected. So what's your wisdom on that?
So from a public health point of view, there's always a balance between the risk and the greater good. And one thing about public health officials that's very important to understand is that they do not like to be associated with any problem, any death of any child or adult or anyone, any death that arises from a public health problem that they could have potentially spotted or averted. That is a very difficult thing for a public health person to understand. The way you framed the question was in terms of the greater good concept. Should we shut down an entire plant because two children seemingly may have been badly affected by the formula manufactured in that plant? That's not a public health perspective. That's more of a practical business and community perspective. But public health officials are super vigilant. We benefit a lot from them being super vigilant. The question is whether or not they can work quickly with Abbott to accommodate some changes, some improvements at the plant to get this plant back up and running.
John, I'm out of time. Do you have a short answer to when do we think the capacity will be back to normal?
We've heard 2 to 3 months. That's a long time to wait, though. But I would, if I may, caution parents out there, please do not hoard baby formula for your own baby. You know, if you have an excess in formula, you have neighbors or friends who have babies who are short of formula, please do share the extra stocks that you've maybe bought up over the last month, knowing about this unfolding crisis.
John Quelch is the author of Consumers, Corporations, and Public Health. He's at the University of Miami. John, thanks for your help today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.